All right, so my name is Jason Cogswell. I'm a student up at the University of Utah. Today I'm interviewing John Cogswell, a little bit about his service. You say who you are? just for purposes.
I'm John Cogswell, father of Jason Cogswell.
Okay. So just, and we have permission to use this.
Yes.
For history. Okay. Just making sure all the legalese is done. So we've talked quite a bit in the past and just about your service and that. We wanted to sit down and just kind of go through your service and what you did for your country.
Okay.
So first of all, how old were you when you joined and why?
I was 19 when I joined up, and the draft was going on at that time. And the draft is done by your birthdays, and so there's 365 days in a year. And if you were, when they pulled the numbers and by your birthdays, if you were number 350, you didn't have to worry about getting drafted. If you were number 1 through about 150, you pretty much knew you were. And if you were the first 50, you're guaranteed. Kiss your butt. And away you go.
So it just went from the first of the year to the end of the year? Is that how they did it? Or how'd they do the lottery?
They did the birthdays. Well, it was by the year you were born, and then by the month and the day. And so they just had a lottery, and they pulled out the birthday numbers, or your birthdays, days of the year, and then that got to be number 1, 2, 3, and up through 365. And so the lower the number, the better chance you were getting drafted. So I came up, and I believe my number was like 86 out of 365. So I knew that I was gonna get drafted, and I didn't wanna go over there. I had no problems in going over to Vietnam, but I didn't wanna end up out in the jungles and fighting hand-to-hand combat if I didn't have to. And so I decided to get an education at the same time, and I went to the Air Force, because they promise you an education. And they give you 3 choices of what field you wanted to go into. And I was going to an automotive school at the time. And I had decided that I didn't really want to do that, but the thought of being an aircraft mechanic really kind of enticed me. And so I thought that would be cool. So that was my number 1 choice. And I can't remember what the other 2 were, but the last one was the field that I ended up going into, of course. And but it was designed to be, it was kind of a wide open field, but it was mainly to be a crew chief on C-130 aircraft. And so I thought, okay, that won't be too bad, you know. But so the crew chief is more of just kind of overseeing the airplane, and all the different mechanics would come in and report to you and then go work on the plane, and you would kind of correlate all that and get it done. There was many other fields. There was regular maintenance in the hangar where you're taking the aircraft apart, and that was part of my field. There was a dual rail system, which was the inner part of the loading and unloading the pallets onto the planes and locking them in place. And that's what I got assigned to my first base that I got assigned to after going through tech school was in Taiwan, and that was CCK or Ching Chong Kong.
So I brought a couple pictures. There weren't a lot of it other than the new ones. Does that remind you? Does that bring back any memories?
Yeah. Yes,
what did you think coming from Iowa going into Taiwan? What were your first impressions?
It was really pretty backwards compared to what I was used to, but it was cool. And I got to know the people over there pretty well. And they were very humble, very good people. And we talked about this before, but around the base is where you kind of get the scum of the people. And so those are the ones that are trying to just make a buck off of you. And that's all the prostitutes and everything else that follows with it. And so used to go off base and get to know those too. But it was a beautiful countryside. And my daughter-in-law is from Taiwan. And talking to her over the years, it's brought back a lot of memories. But I really liked the base, and I got to travel in it. They used to have tours where you could go on the weekends to like different lakes and resorts and that kind of thing. And so I got to see a lot of cool stuff.
Sounds like a pretty cushy post.
It was, especially compared to Vietnam. But I ended up going temporary duty assignment to Vietnam and Thailand, which was in the war zones. And yeah,
Krat?
Krat was in Thailand.
Remember that one? That kind of, I found a few more about Krat. That bring back any memories? At least flying in?
Just the petabikes I do, but it was pretty crap. You couldn't go off the base very much. It was in a pretty hard area, but they did let us go off the base there in Thomsonut Air Base, which was right outside of Saigon, which was their capital of South Vietnam. That was the biggest base over there in the Pacific at the time, I believe. And so it was pretty big, but they didn't allow you to go off base.
On Thomsonut or on...
Yeah, Thomsonut Air Base, because it was too dangerous to go off. So
found that you're flying
in. It was a big base.
Yeah, that
looks like the barracks. So, Airman's Open Mess, yeah, I remember that.
What is that? I guess when you first got there, what was your first impression of Vietnam? Going from Taiwan and Thailand to Vietnam, what was your first impressions there?
You know, I love Taiwan, and I really love Thailand. They're really pretty, but... going to Thomsonut in Vietnam, I think I told you this before, but when you walk off the plane, it has just a total smell of death in the air. I mean, because death was everywhere around there. And when we were talking before, it brought back a memory that I had put out of my mind, but this was shortly after we got there. Being out on the, we used to go out on the flight line all the time to work on the planes. And I came across the back end of a plane that had the tailgate down, and there was body bags with dead Army guys and airmen in there that was stacked like three feet high. And from what I could tell, it just went through all the way up to the front of the airplane. And it's a war zone. And people died, and a lot of people died over there. And I can't remember the exact amount. I know it was over 45,000 people that died over there. But you could just, it was a whole different feeling. And people just didn't care. And I guess they had seen so much death. And before we were there in our war, with North Vietnam, the French were there right before us, and I think they were there for, correct me if I'm wrong, about 6 years or so.
Actually, they owned it before World War I. They colonized it in 1800s.
Wow.
and then lost it to the Japanese in World War II. The Japanese came in, did the same kind of thing to them, basically enslaved and worked them. They worked them for the rubber plants. Huh. And the French tried to take it back after World War II. And then we tried to help them. And then the French got their butts kicked. And that's when we went in.
Yeah, I know that they had basically given up. They had tried to take it back and fight for the cause over there and the freedoms of the South Vietnamese. But I know that they just gave up, and instead of leaving the country abandoned or to North Vietnamese, from what I know of it, was then we went in. And then we got our butts kicked. But the feeling was just, it was total despair over there. People just didn't care. And it was like, not zombies, but as close to it as you can in just normal everyday life. That they were just kind of going through, but there was so much death everywhere that it was really sad. And it was totally different from the beauty of the other countries that I had seen over there.
When did you have much interaction with any of the locals? I know you were on the flight.
There was people that worked on base, and of course, if I remember right, the cafeteria were all locals. You would have a little bit of interaction with them. Every barracks had what they called a mama-san, and she was just there to make sure everything was run smoothly and kept clean. And that, so you did get to know her quite a bit, and the people were nice, from what I could tell, you know.
Just war weary and
yeah, just very
generations
war
weary. Of
war. Yeah, I mean that's all they knew. They grew up in the middle of war, and it always that was their life, so they didn't know anything else.
So okay, we had a picture of the air mess. What was life like on the base?
You just woke up in the morning. That would be the BX, I think.
The BX. Does that ring a bell?
For 50 cents in merchandise. No.
No, those weren't there.
I don't remember that.
But that's your BX.
I think that's the BX. It looks like it. I mean, it's been a long time since I was there, so
yeah,
it's been over 40 years. But yeah, I mean, it was.
Let me see.
What was your question again? What was it
just
like?
What was life like on base?
Yeah, went to sleep at night, and you got up, and you would. The showers were always cold. Water, they didn't have any hot water there whatsoever. So the cold water felt good when you woke up and it was so hot and humid. It was very humid and it felt kind of good. But when winter came, there was no heat in the barracks whatsoever and it was cold.
How cold did it get?
I think it was down like in the 30s and 40s, if I remember right.
So 30 degrees outside, and then you go take a cold shower.
Yeah, it won't kill.
That would get you ready to go to work.
Showers were a lot quicker back then. And then you just go to work and do your job, come back, and it's just an open barracks. So there was bunk beds everywhere within probably 4 feet of each other. And you just either read or listened to music, whatever it may be. But I think they were all long shifts. I think I could be wrong, but it seemed like it was 10-hour shifts that we were doing all the time. But it was just, you know, life in the military is kind of like life anywhere. It's just more confined. So
fun stuff.
Yeah.
So what I know you talked about that you worked on the rails and you worked as a crew chief How did that go? What was that like? I think there's your C-130s.
The whole time that I was in my first tour overseas, I was working on the dual rail system of the planes. And so they would, it's just something that's bolts down inside the plane, and where the pallets come in, they could lock them down, and so they wouldn't go anywhere. And then they had a design where they could release them, and if they were coming down for low drops where they didn't land at all, they would release a pallet, and it would have a parachute on it, and it would pop out the back, and then it would hit the ground, and then whoever was needed that, they'd come running and get what they could out of it and then take off again. The Viet Cong knew that, so there was all kinds of snipers around and shooting our guys up for that. But, or they could be released up high in the air too. But it was a pretty cool system, but I mean.
Like that with a parachute.
Yeah, because they never touched the ground when they would do that, because there was too many chances of them getting shot and not getting back. So they just come in and do these low drops.
Fun.
Other times they would come in and unload their cargo by hand or people. The C-130 is one of the most versatile aircraft. We talked about this before, but it did everything from cargo to people to pigs and chickens. And but they would go in into these areas where they had not tribes, I can't think of.
Villages
that were just living out in the jungles. And the Viet Cong were coming in and gonna capture them or kill them. And so they would come in, make a quick landing, load up all the people and drop them off somewhere else. So they did a lot of that. They would also, it was such a versatile aircraft, they would have load up a 500-pound bomb in the back of the airplane and then do a parachute drop. And when it came down, it'd wipe out everything around the whole area. So you can imagine how big a 500-pound bomb would be.
Yeah.
And the destruction it would do. They also had AC-130s, which was the fighter plane, and it would have Gatling guns all along one side of the plane. And they would come up and be assigned to a certain area, and they were hover over it, and then when they let loose on the Gatling guns and the cannons, they would take and hit every square inch of a football field within like 10 seconds. And anything in that area would just be totally destroyed. And any trees, jungle, or anything would be totally leveled. So it was a pretty versatile airplane. So.
Did you ever go out on any flights with them?
No. The only time I went up on the planes was to go from one area to another. And so when I was flying from Taiwan to Vietnam or Thailand, it'd always be in the back of a C-130. So
did it get messy with all the different types of cargo in there? Did you have to deal with the mess?
No. That was a crew chief's responsibility and other people, so.
So you dodged a bullet not being the crew chief,
yeah,
at least for that part of it.
I did have to change a couple of tires on the plane, and the rear tires, they stand about 5 feet high, and they're probably about 3.5-4 feet wide, just looking down from the front of it, and they're monsters to try and do that. So you can imagine, it's bad enough doing one off of a car, but you try doing it off of an airplane.
What, do you get a little jack? And
it's a big jack.
It's a great big jack, and just tilt the plane. And
yep.
That's funny. Yeah, you don't really think about things like that, that the guys on the ground have to do those.
We did all kinds of different things. So, and the funniest thing was when I was when it was sitting there parked and it had to back up and then go down the runway. This was the first time I ever did it, and I was standing right in front of the plane and directing them to back up, and where I was supposed to be off to the side, and you have the prop wash of these planes, and it was just about knocking me over, and I know that the pilots were just laughing their butts off. So I learned my lesson on that one. So.
they taught the rookie a lesson.
But you'd have the wands, and you'd have to direct them, you know, to come forward.
Oh, so you were on the tarmac.
And there were times that I had to park it, too. So with the wands and directing them, you know, where to go. And so it was a very versatile job. And then I did other things after I came back in different bases. But it was... I did a lot of different things within that career field. So,
wow, that would be fun.
But the whole time I was in the first tour over there, it was all working on the rail system. So, and it was a tough job, and they were about 5 feet long and 2.5 feet wide, and they were heavy, and so you would have to have two guys pick them up and move them and put them on racks to take them out to the planes, or you go out and unload them off the plane. You
probably never want to see one again.
It was interesting. So, it was hard work. So
make you big manly.
Yeah, I was a skinny little guy, but I was very strong.
So, what else did you do on base? What was just
in
play games? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you'd play a lot of card games, and or you would, you know, the big thing back in then was music, and that was when all the different groups, the music groups, were just coming out during that time, and some of them are still touring today that, you know, I used to listen to back then, so.
Okay, so who's the favorite band from that period?
From that period, you probably have never heard of them, but it was Three Dog Night.
Yep.
So that was my favorite band at that time. And the Beach Boys.
And the Beach Boys. That's funny. Yep, I know them. That's really funny. Try. Let me see the next one, though.
B-52s.
The B-52s.
Yeah. Your pictures of the B-52s as B-52 Terror of the Skies. And it was. And we didn't see that many of the B-52s, but we had a few that would come in. And it was interesting. I told you about this. But the plane was so wide. And the wings were just so long that they had to have extra support when they were on the ground with like a little tricycle wheel, and it would plug in underneath the end of the wings. But they were huge planes, and it was amazing what they did. And it was so big, the wings were that they flap like a bird when they're out flying. So
that would be funny. How did they sound when they took off?
Oh, it was just, you couldn't believe the noise that it would make. I mean, it was just, you'd have to cover your ears because it was so loud.
So how do you sleep with planes and that going all night?
You just get used to it. So, I mean, we weren't that far off from the flight line, but you just, like anything else.
Just hear a roar all night, you just tune it out. And
You know, we used to live up in Layton here in Utah, and planes take off all the time and land all the time, and you could be in the middle of a conversation and you just stop talking and wait for the plane to go by and then you resume your talking again.
That's
the way it was off the flight line.
So, I know we talked a little bit before, just that it was a closed base.
Yeah.
That it was dangerous to to be out and about.
It was extremely dangerous to be out on the flight lines, and they would have armed guards there all posted all around. And like your picture shows, that there are sandbags and little huts that they would go into. But the Viet Cong were just everywhere. And most of the time, you never saw them, or never heard of them. But every once in a while, they would try and get on base, and you'd hear a shootout. And we talked about this last time, but they used to send kids, and mostly females, and then some kids, and they would strap a bomb to their chest, and they had these pins sticking out all over the bomb, and they were told to run up and run into an airplane or whatever else was big, and it would hit it and they would blow up the planes. And I heard at least 10 planes blow up from these guys. But the guards out on the flight lines, they would look for them. Like, well, you did good.
So I'll try.
And they were told to shoot them dead on sight, because they were their whole job was to go and blow up something, and it would be anywhere from 5-year-old kids to adults, and it was really sad. And I even saw a few of them while I was out on the flight line, and they would tell us immediately to alert the security guards to them, but to not go near them.
Did you just see them walking across the field, like
running? On the flight lines, and trying to get to the planes?
How do you even react to that?
You always have to be on guard for it, and that was just a way of life. And it was, we were at war. So, and luckily, I didn't have to deal with them individually, but, you hear the security guard shoot at them, and then they'd haul them off. And
so the aftermath would be...
Yeah, exactly. So you've got a picture of a C-130 there, half blown up. And that's where it came from.
So that is exactly what it would look like, huh?
Yep.
How did it... the sound of explosions, what does that do anymore?
It's pretty scary. So,
what did it sound like? Was it?
Yeah, just a huge explosion. I mean, and there was also F-4 fighter jets there out there on the flight line too. And they were the main target, because the F-4s were out there, swooping in and killing everybody. And so it was just dangerous. I mean, we had a pretty good compared to the Army guys, but we had our danger spots too. And it was just there. And you just had to be wary of it.
So how often did you see planes come in blowing up?
All the time. So, we used to drive around on the flight line, and I used to sneak pictures of them, and we weren't allowed to take them, of course, but, 19-year-old kid, you're going to do what you want to do
pictures
and everything. But come in, and I had a couple pictures of F-4 jets that the whole tail was just blown off. I mean, just totally gone. And how they made it back, I don't know. And they would come in with the wingtips totally blown off right up to, some of the engines. And they were just shredded everywhere. And we had our planes, the C-130s, and we talked about this before, but when I was working at night, we used to watch them come in, and because their missions were usually at night, because it was the most safe for our guys, and that's how they would target them. But I don't know how many planes I saw come in totally shot up with over 500 bullet holes in the wings, and water, not water, but gas was just pouring out from all these bullet holes. And they couldn't do anything until it was drained out of the flight line. And then they'd come in and wash everything off and then home off and repair them. And we had, I saw personally at least five or six C-130s that were just about ready to land and just blew up and disintegrated. They were just gone. They were so shot up that they just couldn't make it back. And they made it back to the just right above, you know, 6 feet off the ground getting ready to land. And they just totally blew up and just a huge, huge fireballs. And then you think about, you know, those are our guys inside there. And those are our pilots and the crew. And it does things to you. It messes you up. So.
What kind of effects have you had? It, obviously, that does some things to you. You know, you were on base, but what kind of things does that do to your thinking for the rest of your life?
Well, at that time, it made you scared. And, I mean, you're scared for your life, but it hardens you. So, I mean, it just makes you where you don't care as much, you know. And it took a long time to get over that. So, I mean, now I don't have any problems with it, but it took a long time. And it affects you, the way you react to things, the way you think about things, and how you look towards life. And so it changes you. So luckily I have a great wife and she, you know, we have a great relationship, and 5 great kids and 12 grandkids and 1 great grandchild. And I'm very blessed. So very blessed. But it can screw you up. And you know, you look at, people don't understand when these guys come back from war zones. And like I said, I had it pretty easy being in the Air Force compared to the Army. But it can screw you up, and some people never get out of it. So,
when you came home, what was your reaction? Or what was the reaction of people to you when you came back?
Vietnam was a very unpopular war. And there was all kinds of protests going on, and people looked down on you. I mean, you're over there fighting for your country and for everybody's freedoms, and you come back and they look at you. I never had this, but a lot of people got spit on, and you can just tell they're looking down on you like scum, and which is totally wrong, because we're there fighting for everybody's freedom. And, you know, it was during the hippie movement, and, you know, they were trying to get us out of there, and I totally understand that. And it was not a war that we really wanted to be in. And we didn't have a lot of controls over there, but for people to look down on you and think you're scum just because you're in the military, it's just wrong. And when I ended up getting out of the military 6.5 years later to go to school, when I came home and got out of the military, I gave away everything. I gave away all my uniforms and anything really had to do with the military, because I didn't want to be reminded of it. And that's wrong. And I wish I would have kept them. The only thing I kept was I can't remember what they call it, the jacket that they give you. But, and then I kept a couple of the camouflage sets of uniforms because they were cool. So, but I just wanted to get away from it all and not be looked down and mistreated. It's totally different from what people have today. I mean, people come back as heroes and, you know, they're, I have parades for them and, you know, tell them what great job they're doing and that. I mean, they always try now when I go to the VA hospital, you know, they always thank you for your service and that. And it was totally different back then. So, totally different. But I'm proud that I was in the military, and I'm proud of the job I did. And I'm glad I did. I learned a lot from it all. So.
Has your views of what happened in Vietnam changed over the years from your perception then to your perception now? And
oh, yeah. I mean, now, you know, you could see somebody from North Vietnam and it'd be no big deal. I mean, there's, you know, we've had interactions with the presidency of the United States, you know, and going over to Vietnam and all that's over. But at the time, I hated the North Vietnamese. I mean, just despised them. So, and it was mostly because of what they were doing to us. And I mean, that's part of war. And it took me a long time to change my viewpoint on that. Now I could shake hands or hug them or do whatever, you know, they're just people. So just, you know, and so are we. But at that time we were sworn enemies, so.
Mm-hmm. Just one of the last things, we're gonna skip that. I know we've talked about it before, but Agent Orange and what that's done. What do you remember of it when you were there? And
you know, while I was there, I never even heard of Agent Orange. I know that they were spraying chemicals for the jungles, and that's basically what Agent Orange is. It was to go out and spray all the areas and to kill off the vegetation so that the Viet Cong couldn't sneak up on us and kill us. But it's done a lot. I've been totally affected by it in my life. I have severe arthritis because of it. It's done a lot of things to my body, and I'm a disabled vet because of it, and just seeing that picture is hard for me because I know what it's done to me and affected me. I think it's when my wife Liz was over in the Philippines, they were still spraying Vietnam at that time and coming back with the baby lifts, and I would have to work on those planes, and so I don't know if, I'm sure it was the time that I was in Vietnam, but also the time in the Philippines, and but I got subject to the side effects of it, and it's hurt me, and there's a lot of pain every day. Severe pain, and it's like eating away at my body. So, and that's pretty tough. But you know, it was something I don't think they knew. They could have of the side effects that it would cause. But there was a lot of people a lot worse off from it. The troops that were on the ground, they had to go through all the jungles right after they sprayed. Those are the guys that really horribly got deformed over it. So,
what do you think? The perception of it has changed now. Did they told you anything about it?
They're still very quiet about it all. I mean, I went in, had a physical done, had to give the times that I was there, and but the VA is still dead quiet about it, and it's very frustrating because I know I'm very sick from it all, but they go in and look at you, but they don't give you much feedback from it all. So it's one of those things that it's a cover up from the military, and they don't want to acknowledge it. It took them a long time to even acknowledge that they did it, and especially to the extent that they did. But even today, they're just ignoring
it. They didn't bring it up. You had to bring it up.
Oh yeah, you have to bring it up. You have to go in and initiate everything. And they, you know, it's pretty hush hush. So it's not right.
No, it's not. I have some documents. I don't have it on here right now, but in the International Court of Law, they found Monsanto, Dow Chemical, and the United States government liable of war crimes because of using that on it.
I'm sure.
And they're not going to persecute, or they're not going to, they can't prosecute.
Yeah.
You can't prosecute the United States government.
In some ways, I mean, this is just my own opinion, but in some ways, they had to have known what it was going to do to people, so, when they were doing it. But it was probably worth it for a few thousand troops to, you know, deal with the aftermath versus the good that it did, so. And I'm sure that that's the way to look at it, but when you're one of those people that's suffering from it, it sucks.
So. It's not. Just any final words, any final thoughts about...
Well, we haven't talked about it yet, but there was... When I was in Vietnam, is when they... All of a sudden, they issued us flak vests, helmets, and M16s. And we were told to carry them at all times. And we found out right after they issued it to us, there was a warning that the Viet Cong could attack the base. And ended up being that they had the base, and this was a huge base, but they had the whole entire base surrounded with missiles that they were going to shoot into the base. And they had thousands, hundreds of thousands of troops lined up all around and hidden in the jungles around the base.
And what year was this? Was it 72?
No, it would have been 71, I think.
71.
But they were, and then they also had all these missiles and all the troops surrounded around Saigon, too. And Saigon was a huge city. Back then, it was it was the capital of South Vietnam. But the idea was that if we didn't come to some type of a peace treaty, or that a troop withdrawal, then we found out that they were just going to obliterate the base and everything. And this went on for about 3 days, and it was the only time I was really scared over there. And it was pretty fearful knowing that, that they could come in and take over the base, and they had the ability to do that, and they had the people to do it. And if we were going to get killed right outright, or tortured, or what? So, but that went on for 3 whole days, and I can only picture myself in that. Versus these guys that are out in the jungles and fearing for their lives all the time and being shelled and waiting for other troops to come in and try and, help them withdraw from that. But that affected me for quite a while. So, and it was, like you said, it was the only time that I was really scared
and
what was going to happen to me. But it was war.
It was war.
Things happen in war. A lot of bad things. And I was lucky that I joined the Air Force and that I didn't end up on the front lines. But I was more than proud to be there and serving. And so I went there, volunteered twice, 3 months at a time out of a 15-month tour I spent. 6 months in Vietnam and 3 months at Karat Air Force Base in Thailand, and that was right off the front lines there. And but I wanted to be there to support the troops who were there and to do my part. So.
Any final words for anybody? For your...
I'm glad, as I said, I'm glad I went in the military. I got my VA benefits from it for buying homes with no money down. I've got my VA education. There's been total benefits, and the VA hospital is, I'm so blessed to be able to go there and get treated there. And everybody's very helpful. And as I said, I learned a lot from my military service, and I spent 2 years after that in the Philippines, and time here in Utah after I came back from Vietnam, and then spent over a year in North Carolina. So I was in a lot of different places during that time frame that I was in, but it taught me a lot and matured a lot, and I think it's helped me in dealing with people all my life, but also being blessed. I really realize from being in the different countries and the third world countries overseas, at that time they were third world countries, and how blessed we are here and what we have. And just as simple as running tap water and air conditioning, and they didn't have that. So they were just bare-bone existing. So, But it makes you appreciate what you got when you come back. So, and the freedoms that we have.
Wow.
That's about it.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.